The Honorable Judge Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. We are now calling case A19-1912, James Francis Vierling versus the state of Minnesota.
Good morning. Let me thank you all for being willing to participate in this remote argument. We did a test a minute ago to make sure we could all hear each other. If for some reason you're unable to hear something or there's a problem on your end, let us know right away and we'll do the best we can to accommodate that. I also want to mention that there is one of the screens displaying how much time is left. And if you're in the gallery view, you'll be able to see it. If you're in speaker view, you might not be able to see it because it might be a thumbnail size. So make sure you toggle to the gallery view so you know how much time is left. And we expect the occasional interruption. We'll do the best we can to have patience and limit our interruptions this morning to the best we can. Mr. Kelly, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning, counsel. This case, I believe there's very little dispute as to the findings of fact made by the district court. There is conclusions of law which are reviewed de novo, and the plaintiff is requesting this court reverse the district court's denial of the post-conviction petition seeking a vacation of a sentence and a remand for a new trial. The petitioner refers this court to our addendum 3. That is the district court order. I believe that that is a good starting place for this court to get a kind of an overview, capsulized, of the facts of this case and what brings us before this court. There were three findings in that order.
Mr. Kelly, if I may, it seems that the first thing this court should address is whether there is a legal excuse or justification or a way to excuse the untimely nature of this post-conviction petition. I don't think there's any dispute that it was late, correct? Outside of the two-year statutory period?
That's correct.
So why should this court consider it?
So it's part three of my argument. And that two-year window is not absolute. There needs to be that it can be shown that it's in the interest of justice, that it can be waivable by this court. It is not an absolute jurisdictional window that closes if it is in the interest of justice. And the reason why it's in the interest of justice relates to the violations themselves. This is a prosecutorial, a failure to disclose a summary of a trial witness that would have been very helpful to the defendant at the time, and no prejudice need be shown. Jumping around a little bit in my argument,
but Mr. Kelly, Mr. Kelly, before you go farther with that, you know, I understand you're not disputing the district court's findings of fact, and I mean one of those findings is your client was aware, you know, before sentencing, and that in fact there was this 2005 allegation. So how does the interest of justice exception apply when it's clear that your client knew, in fact, prior to sentencing, so long before the two-year period would have commenced, about this undisclosed allegation of earlier misconduct?
So the window of opportunity, factually, to raise this claim closed in July 2018. That's because there was no direct appeal taken from the case. So the final blow of the discovery violation was not felt until September 11, 2018, when he was sentenced on a subsequent offense, and the district court denied a downward dispositional departure motion, citing this conviction. Also, the biggest impact of the discovery violation was not felt until the subsequent trial, when this conviction was introduced at trial to discredit my client. Now, this was a slow drip. And initially, he did find out about the statements that were not disclosed when at the last second, a plea offer was made to him. Okay. But the impact of this discovery violation lingered on for a long period of time. There was no direct appeal taken. Once I got the transcripts of the trial and understood the discovery violation, we immediately filed an appeal. We immediately requested for a post-conviction petition, and we did the best we could. But once again, my client's not a legal expert. He doesn't understand that what 901 requires. And while he entered into a deal that kept him out of prison. So the entire time that he enters into this deal, where he's not on equal footing with the prosecutor, this is not an arm's length negotiation. He doesn't know everything the prosecutor knows when he enters into that deal that he needs to know. So initially he enters a deal.
The unequal footing, is that tied to a rule of criminal procedure or a case that requires that there be some disclosure by the prosecutor beyond what the rules of procedure would require? Well,
plea agreements are in and of themselves contracts, and contract law, if there is intentional withholding of material information, that contract is void. I mean, this is simple contract law that indicates that the defendant gets disclosure so that he can enter into intelligent negotiations. And when he waives his right to trial and accepts a probationary deal, which once again, the record is completely absent of any explanation as to why a prison deal went to a probationary deal once the prosecutor had information that the defendant didn't, but that's what happened.
Can I just take you back? I don't know. Can I be heard? I'm not sure if my audio is okay.
I'm clear, Judge.
Thank you. I'm curious about that prop. Your maybe it's just I don't want to take us down a rabbit trail, but your proposition of law that in contract law, a failure to disclose information voids the contract. I'm not familiar with that doctrine.
Well, there's no meeting of the minds. I confess that very little contract. A law experience, but you've got the Baron Cow case, right? You need to have a meeting of the minds. You can't have one side withholding material information and enter into the contract. And certainly the fact that you know this was going to result in I think it was 16 months later, criminal charges of a more serious nature. I don't believe that plea agreement is a fair deal. It's not a fair deal because the information is being withheld. And the district court found that there was no 901 violation because the statement that the made by the only eyewitness, child one, that the petitioner had committed another crime prior to the date in question that was going to trial. That is simply, I can't even imagine where that isn't a 901 violation.
Well, how does child one's October 13th, 2015 disclosure of then uncharged sexual abuse allegations from 10 years earlier relate to your client's guilt or innocence of the 2015 assault charge?
So you've got two issues there. Number one, the defense counsel would be able to use the allegation as an ulterior motive to fabricate the current case. So it's good for cross-examination at trial. And it's also, or an example of exaggeration. If they're the sole witness at trial to an offense, says to a prosecutor, that guy that I'm going to be testifying tomorrow and potentially putting in prison, 10 years ago, he burned me on a business deal and he owes me $100,000 on a judgment I've never collected. Now that business deal has nothing to do with the trial that's about to happen where an assault allegation is being made. But that prior dispute, that prior motivation to get back at somebody is fair cross-examination material. You're saying this because, in fact, you're bitter about something that happened 10 years ago. You can't say it doesn't relate to the case. You have to disclose that, especially when it's the only eyewitness to the crime, not some collateral matter. But the state, then the court moves on from 901 and says, well, if it is a 901 violation, there's no prejudice. And that's not the law. The law says that we don't have to show prejudice, that this court in its supervisory role of discovery can say there you don't need to show prejudice. We can step in. Any gains made by failure to disclose should always be at risk once identified. Those gains should be at risk once the discovery violation is identified. We think we can show prejudice because it would have resulted in a different trial had the defendant rejected the plea. And he testified that had I known about the new allegations, I wouldn't have taken the deal at the time. Substantial rights were waived based upon that non-disclosure, and there was prejudice. Again,
I hear some echoing, so apologize for that. But when did Mr. Vierling first become aware of the new allegations?
Through counsel, I believe he first became aware of a potential allegation in a CHIPS matter immediately prior to sentencing on the second degree. But that CHIPS matter was then dismissed and did not proceed to trial.
So prior to sentencing. And there was no motion to withdraw from the plea agreement at that point.
That is correct. However, that CHIPS matter was dismissed and the substance of that allegation was never pursued in a CHIPS trial. So there may have been some perception on everyone's part that that allegation lacked sufficient proof to proceed forward, certainly as to a criminal prosecution.
Well, and in fact, at sentencing, as I understand it, your client's counsel specifically urged the district court to disregard those allegations about the 2005 conduct so that it wouldn't spill over into any sentence, correct?
I believe that that was a request. I think that the district court cited the prior in saying, I'm not going to grant the downward departure motion in part because this isn't your first rodeo. You know, you've got another conviction. So it was used against him by the district court at sentencing. So we believe we have a 901 violation that it should have been disclosed. The district court comes to a conclusion. The addendum on page 8. The district court, addendum 3, page 8, is the district court order denying.
Mr. Kelly, can I go back? I thought your client, in fact, got the benefit of the plea agreement and received a downward dispositional sentence. Am I wrong about that?
That's accurate. He's on probation right now on this file. That's correct.
Okay, I thought.
But he was executed on the subsequent file where this was introduced at trial, and the downward dispositional departure on that case was denied because of this conviction. The district court said that the standard proposed by the petitioner would expand 901 to require the state to turn over all potentially inculpatory information that it has received concerning the defendant, including information unrelated, pending, or ongoing investigations that may or may not lead to future charges against the defendant at the time of an offer or acceptance of a plea. And that statement mischaracterizes the petitioner's argument. we agree that that should not be the standard. The standard should be when the sole witness at trial is saying that there's a prior offense, which has not been reported and has not been prosecuted. Now it relates directly to the case, not all information. I thought that was a straw man finding, and it's not the law.
So let me interject a bit, because I think this discussion relates in two parts to your issues on appeal. The first is as to whether or not there is prejudice for a Rule 9 violation, perhaps even whether there was a Rule 9 violation. But it also is part of your argument as to why the interest of justice would allow a late. So turning specifically to, as best as I can crystallize them, the rule that you want us to either adopt or apply is that the interest of justice exception allows for a post-conviction, outside the time limits, a post-conviction petition, when somebody learns of a potential statement of a witness, learns of a statement of a potential witness pre-sentencing, but does not seek to withdraw the plea on that basis, it still is in the interest of justice to require disclosure of those statements. And so that's my question. How can it be so important that it triggers the interest of justice exception, but not so important that it would have resulted in a motion to withdraw from the plea? That information is either really important, and if it, as you're saying it is, then the trial attorney at that time would have wanted to potentially go to trial.
So there isn't an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, but I think a petition, I think a motion to withdraw could have been raised at that time. I think that the interest of justice from the perspective of this court with regard to the NAFLA rule is affected by the fact that this starts with the prosecution. It's not up to the defendant to clean up that mess in a timely fashion. I would submit that when this type of discovery violation happens, this court should step in past that two-year rule and say, when we can be shown that you profited, that you hoodwinked somebody into a deal, we don't care when they come in, if that's what's shown. There is no typical, especially when there's been no direct appeal, because the 90-day window closes so fast. So that would be my response, Your Honor.
Okay, I don't see other questions, and your time has expired for now. Let's turn to respondents' argument. Ms. Forbes, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. To first begin, I would like to address the timeliness of the post-conviction motion. As the court is aware, there is a timeline of events, which I won't go over in detail, but the timeline here is very important, not only to this discovery issue, but first to the timeliness of the post-conviction motion. Under the statute, the appellant had 2 years to make this post-conviction motion. The first exception that the district court examined was the exception in paren B under 590.01 subdivision 4 that allows for a motion outside of the 2 year time frame if there's newly discovered evidence that could not have been ascertained by exercise of due diligence. The district court found that the appellant didn't even assert that the trial outcome would have been different since this was a knowing and intelligent voluntary plea negotiation issue and not a trial issue, and that the only allegation here is that he just wouldn't have accepted the plea. The district court also found that appellant did not establish that the evidence would have been used for anything beyond impeachment, which is clearly not allowed under that provision of the statute. The interest of justice requires a little bit more analysis, and the interest of justice standard is really turns on, in the court's analysis, in the district court's analysis, on the appellant's inaction. And the district court relied on the appellant's inaction, as it should. appellant's inaction in moving towards withdrawing a plea once he became aware of the allegation here. That shows, that demonstrates that he has not met his burden of the interest and just of justice standard. We have a clear timeline. The appellant had actual knowledge dating back to November of 2015 when an investigator contacted his counsel of the CHIPS case and wanted to take a statement regarding this new allegation. The allegation was also referenced in the CHIPS case in April of 2016 by that intermediate dispositional order that dated back to March of 2016. Again, the appellant did not take any action with this knowledge. The appellant was even charged with the new allegation in January of 2017. A history of relationship notice was provided in October 2017. All of this happened within the two-year time frame in which the motion for post-conviction relief would have been timely, and appellant did nothing. In fact, this was a 15-month overlap of when this new charge was filed, so he was aware that he was going to
Ms. Forbes, I don't think that you could say inaction or failure to file a petition within the 2 years means that there's no possibility that this is in the interest of justice, right? That's the exception to the two-year time limit. So I don't think failing to file for 2 years would preclude someone from coming back and saying it's in the interest of justice. Let me ask it a little differently. The evidence in this case is Giglio evidence, evidence that could have been used to impeach a witness. What if it had been Brady evidence? What if it had been inculpatory evidence that had been withheld? Exculpatory evidence that had been withheld. There's still the same inaction. 2 years have passed, and now you have somebody who's now trying to, whether it's because they have benefit of new counsel or they just have changed their mind, it doesn't really matter. Under the interest of justice, would it be enough enough to satisfy that exception if there had been exculpatory information that wasn't provided by the prosecution?
I think in certain circumstances that could be enough, but what we have here is the information was actually provided. And even if that information had been Brady material, appellant took no action on this file to address the Brady violation before sentencing, since he knew before sentencing. So I think that his inaction in both lack of filing a post-conviction motion and for lack of filing for a motion to withdraw the plea based on becoming aware of this evidence, that is where the interest of justice is not met. So what is important is to note is that nothing changed between the time where it would have been timely and when the actual petition was filed. The new charge, the criminal sexual conduct charge, was filed in late January of 2017. This gave the appellant an ample opportunity to address the plea that he entered and either try to withdraw the plea or take some other post-conviction action. Nothing changed between those timeframes. So to say that he had to wait until he knew the results of sentencing is not, that just lacks merit. The appellant's argument that he was unable to address the fact of conviction in time for trial, that he had to wait for the trial to actually commence, that argument is unavailing. First, it was the only thing allowed in the trial was the conduct itself, not the fact of conviction. The state was not allowed to use the fact of conviction when talking about the relationship evidence. Had the plea actually been withdrawn, the conduct still would have been fair game for history of relationship evidence. And second, the district court found, and the appellant does not argue or disagree, that it was the appellant's trial strategy to use this conviction, not the state's. And additionally, to say that the appellant couldn't anticipate the danger of a prior felony or relationship evidence coming in until after the trial happened also is unavailing, again, because nothing changed between when this was charged and when it would have been timely to file a post-conviction relief. And many defendants come to trial with prior felonies or with relationship evidence. That's why we have the rules of evidence to provide guidance on these issues. So to say that I couldn't have anticipated the prejudice of a prior felony, that argument is without merit.
Ms. Forbes, how do you respond to, you know, what I guess what I perceive as sort of an argument that the interests of justice exception should be expanded in situations such as this, where the parties to a plea agreement come to the table with vastly different information bases, where, you know, the deal was reached before Mr. Vierling had any idea of a 2005 complaint or allegation of sexual misconduct. Why isn't that coming to the table with vastly different information, especially when it's the prosecutor not disclosing, why isn't that the sort of situation that this court should say the interests of justice would support consideration of an otherwise untimely post-conviction petition?
The interest of justice is not served when the appellant here, as in here, had ample opportunity to argue that he was not on equal footing with the prosecutor after he became aware of this new charge and the underlying conduct. So I think that to apply the interest of justice standard where appellant just takes no action would open the door to people relying on the interest of justice standard simply for a change of mind, which is not the standard, and would make the 2-year time limitation pretty much moot. So the appellant also argues that one of the factors does favor him. The respondent did argue the factors that apply to an interest of justice standard, and I won't review all of the factors because they are quite lengthy, but the appellant only argued one of the factors, claiming prejudice that he did not have the opportunity to correct. To claim that he could not have known the prejudice until trial, that this case where it's a delayed report of almost 10 years, this is the type of case that turns on credibility. There's no physical evidence, and that's not a surprise. To claim that we had to wait till trial to discover that this case turns on credibility lacks merit. That could easily have been ascertained by review of the initial discovery. So the appellant did not need to wait until trial to figure this out. The only factor seems to be the fourth factor that appellant argued in his brief. So it's respondent's position that the other factors should be deemed waived. Next, moving into the discovery violation issue, the respondent maintains that there was no discovery violation here. And even if there was a discovery violation, the district court did not err in holding that there was no prejudice.
Mr. Kelly suggests that there's no prejudice. There's no requirement that prejudice be demonstrated if there is a showing that Rule 901 has been violated. Is he right?
No. Prejudice is the general rule. Not showing prejudice or being relieved of that is the exception to the rule. The cases that appellant cites arguing that he should not have to bear the burden of showing any type of prejudice were cases that are very factually dissimilar to this case, as in the Kaiser case or the Moore case. These are cases in which the material specifically relates to that case, and by the state's discovery violation, effectively circumvented any type of a defense that the appellant or the defendant in those cases could make, such as telling a witness not to talk about an alternative perpetrator. The defendant in that case could have explored that. There was another case where the failure to disclose induced or at least did not give the defendant all of the information he needed to waive a marital privilege, which turned out to be a very important aspect in that trial, given the spouse was the alibi. So these cases are factually very dissimilar because they all relate to that case, and they were all very important evidence in that case, and they were all in bad faith. And the later cases, such as Jackson, do go on to state that showing prejudice is the general rule, and being relieved of showing prejudice is the exception. The post-conviction court found that here the allegation was not related to the second degree assault because of this, no discovery violation had occurred. They were significantly separated.
Well, let me jump back in, because I think that the characterization of that evidence by the district court is different from how appellant's characterizing the value or the purpose of that evidence. It's not evidence of an offense. It's evidence that could be used to impeach, or evidence that witnesses trying to retaliate. So in that context, doesn't the prosecution have the requirement to disclose statements that can be used to impeach their own witnesses?
The state is not suggesting that the prosecution has no duty to provide impeachment evidence of its own witness. However, this evidence was different in that it was significantly separate from the case at bar. This required a new...
But not so separate that the conduct isn't of the first case isn't used as 63420. So it's connected enough, right? That in the second trial, you have both incidents. What about the argument that had trial counsel in the first case known of this evidence, they maybe would have tried to bargain differently? We see lots of plea bargains where the state is agreeing not to charge certain conduct. And couldn't the defense have said, well, I'll plead to something and I'll take an agreement if you agree not to charge this new thing that you've now been made aware of? And instead, what happens is the state charges him with this new crime. So isn't there something that the state would be obligated to do in that context, getting back to Judge Bjorkman's concern about the asymmetrical information that the parties had access to?
The requirement that, or the purported requirement that appellant wants to use here, that both parties be on equal footing, is not the standard under the rule. If appellant had wanted to seek a global resolution for cases involving the child here, appellant could have sought a global resolution because there were other sexual abuse allegations that were disclosed in the initial discovery, but appellant chose not to do that.
Okay. Well, I don't see any other questions. So we will turn back to you, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you. Just briefly, I would refer this court to, once again, addendum 3 in my brief, the bottom of page 4, top of page 5. These are facts found by the district court in denying my petition for post-conviction relief. Citing that on July 3rd, the state notified petitioner of intent to impeach him if he were to testify, with prior felony convictions, including his conviction in this file, which is now on appeal. And then, once again, prior to the trial in the CFC case, at the top of page 5, the court ruled petitioner's conduct in this case could be entered as evidence to demonstrate the nature and extent of the relationship between the petitioner and child one. So here we have court rulings saying that these assaults are interrelated sufficiently regarding relationship between the state's only witness, eyewitness at trial, and my client. But then the prosecution argues that they're not relating to the case under 901. And this is a logical disconnect, I would submit to this court. The decisions of trial counsel are always difficult, and you have to, once you get rulings from the court about how prior convictions are going to be entered, you have to make some trial tactical decisions. And those decisions, I think, definitely would have been different had this prior conviction for the knife assault not been looming in the background. And we don't know how those decisions would have been made differently.
Mr. Kelly, isn't the same true for the first case, that there are tactical decisions being made? And it seems a simple tactical decision is you take the plea that you're given that allows for a probationary sentence rather than go to trial and cross-examine a child witness about a statement of some additional first-degree conduct. Doesn't that seem like the logical trial strategy? And that explains why there was no motion to withdraw from the plea in the first case, because it would have backfired.
Well, I guess I did. That wasn't me. I'm not sure. I understand what the question is assuming, and I think it's logical. Where that leaves a person, you know, maybe if we don't withdraw our plea, they won't charge us. Keep in mind that he wasn't even charged with the CSC that they had probable cause to charge on October 13th of 2015 until January 2017, if I've got my dates correct. I mean, why the 16-month delay in charging? Meanwhile, NAFLA clock is ticking.
And by the same token, I mean, your client was aware when he pleaded guilty that there were allegations of sexual misconduct from 2010. I mean, that was included in the police incident report. And he made a tactical decision on October 14th that despite knowing about this potential charges from 2010, he was going to accept what seemed like a favorable plea. I don't understand how the 2005 episode is any different, other than the fact that ultimately that was what was charged out and not the 2010.
The 2010 assault was never charged out, and presumption is that they didn't feel, but not if they don't have proof beyond reasonable doubt, and not if they don't have can't convince the jury of that. So if they're aware of it and they're not charging it, that's a lot different than being aware of something that they haven't declined to charge yet, you know, that you don't know about. So if he feels like there was an allegation of during a spanking episode that there was a digital penetration and there's other witnesses present at the time, and he's going to win that case if it ever gets charged. I mean, it's a completely different fact pattern that's never pursued by the state, but the one that's not disclosed is then later pursued 16 months later. I see I've only got a few seconds left, and I appreciate the court's time. I'm going to conclude with this quote from Schwantes that talks about this prejudice, the need to show this prejudice or not. And the Schwantes case is the marital spousal privilege waiver, that this adversarial system of trial is not yet a poker game in which players enjoy the absolute right always to conceal their cards until played. And that is citing Williams. In Florida, U.S. Supreme Court case. And they found that although Schwantes' evidence was substantial, and his proof of the guilt was strong anyway, even without the failure to disclose, Schwantes was going to lose. The court still stepped in and said, even though, you know, they can't show prejudice because he's going to lose anyway, we're not going to let this stand. So that would be my final submission. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments and your submissions. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue a decision within the statutory timeframe.